Sound Philosophy, a podcast exploring philosophical and interpretive issues in the history of popular music and sometimes in the history of philosophy itself. In this episode, I'm joined once again by Eric Taxier to discuss the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle, this time chapters 12 and 13 from book one, thus finishing book one. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy. I'm joined once again by Eric Taxier, and now we're going to finish up book one of the Nicomachean Ethics. We're going to deal with chapters 12 and 13 of the of book one of the Nicomachean Ethics, which means that in the next episode, we'll be moving on to book two, which begins the exploration of the virtues, and we'll talk about that a bit in chapter 13, since chapter 13 acts as more or less a transition into book two. But first, of course, we want to deal with chapter 12. To my mind, chapter 12 is one of the odd chapters, maybe in the entire treatise. It's the one that when I first read the treatise, I kind of scratched my head and said, well, that's not very important, and didn't think about it much for years and years. And now here we are back with it. And I got to admit, I'm still confused about it. But since I know that we have to talk about it, I've given it a lot more thought. So we'll see where it goes. I'm going to give a kind of, I don't think overly glib, summary of it, but I'm going to give a summary of it to get us started, and then we'll sort of go from there. The chapter basically concerns happiness and whether it's something that is praiseworthy or something that is honorable, right? And notice, I'll read the first very short paragraph. It says, now that we have determined these points, meaning all the things that we've said about happiness, let us consider whether happiness is something praiseworthy or instead something honorable, for clearly it is not a capacity. And then in parentheses, Irwin puts, which is neither praiseworthy nor honorable, right? So in other words, once again, when we're talking about happiness, we're not talking about the potential for happiness. Just like we're not really talking about the potential for virtue. When, if you remember a few chapters ago, Aristotle said, well, we don't really praise children for their virtue, but rather for the virtue, the blessedness that they may one day enjoy, right? So when we say, oh, that's such a good boy, we don't really mean that that boy is yet a paragon of virtue, because that's not really possible for a child, according to Aristotle, because so much of virtue is informed by rational thought, and children are still developing their rational thought. So it's not a capacity, it's something inact, and something that is actuated, something that is made manifest. And so then the question becomes, is it praiseworthy or honorable? And you can see why I might have scratched my head at such a distinction. Who cares? Why does it matter whether it's praiseworthy or honorable? Well, let's dig a little deeper and see what he has to say about it, right? He says that things that are praiseworthy are praised for their character and the state in relation to something else. So anything that is praised is about its character, about the quality of it. That's not surprising. One would assume that anything that we claim is honorable is also because of its character. But that what's important is the relationality. And so we're back to this in relation to situation with Aristotle, which informs all of his thinking, right? And so this is one way in which I think this chapter is starting to show up for me in a way that it didn't before, because I got too sort of caught up in the what I originally thought of as a kind of non-distinction between praise and honor, and therefore I lost what the actual distinction is, which is based on this relationality thing, which is so important to Aristotle, because everything is either in relation to something or is in itself, right? I mean, we saw that over and over again. That's the whole point of the sciences, of the teleology. So if you think of teleology as basically being a kind of hierarchized arrow, right, where you can almost imagine it is almost like an arrowhead, like a triangle, because I'm assuming that things that are lower in the hierarchy, there's more of those types of things, right? So if you think of all the things that you do, including itching your feet, going for a walk, watching a certain amount of television, sleeping for a certain amount of hours, some of those things are clearly more important to your livelihood and your happiness than others, right? And I'm assuming that the things that are on a fairly low level, there's probably a lot of those, right? Things that we could do with or without, for instance, right? For instance, it probably doesn't matter that much if you iron your laundry or you don't, as far as your happiness goes. But it's somewhere there in your life, right? And so it's somewhere in that hierarchy. And so everything with Aristotle, it seems to me, is this kind of funneling, where you have all these things at the bottom, and then there are fewer and fewer as you get toward the top. And when you get to the top, it's like the Highlander. There's only one, right? Because everything points to it. And so that thing is the in itself. Now, when we're talking about sciences, that in itself is a principle, right? It's the first principle from which everything else follows. And notice that this is actually going to become important in a way that I would not have thought of when I was just remembering my years-old reading of this chapter. That for Aristotle, remember that there is no science of first principles. First principles are the basis for science, and you can't prove first principles within the science because they're the baseline assumption for that science, and everything follows from that first principle and then sort of gets reabsorbed back into it. So I sort of think of, and this is partly my Aquinas understanding of it, but I think Aquinas is right about this, that what the first principle does is it has in nous, in a kind of embryonic form, everything that you need to know, but it's not fleshed out. And then as you work out the science, you realize that everything follows from that first principle. And what you're really doing is expanding your understanding of that first principle. In a way, when you first get a first principle, all you're getting is a kind of insight, a kind of, not quite an intuition, something more than an intuition, but a kind of insight that's not fully fleshed out. But everything will follow from that. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, those of you who are familiar with Aristotle, wait, there is a science of first principles. It's called metaphysics. But Aristotle spends a lot of time talking about metaphysics not quite being a real science, right? It's above the sciences. It's above the physics. It's something beyond. There is no science of being as such, even though he can discuss being, right? It's just he doesn't feel he has a full science of it because you don't have a first principle that anchors all the rest of it. That's what metaphysics does, is it examines first principles.
Well, just to make sure I understand what you mean, and maybe we can try to apply it to this theme of happiness too. So the first principle is something that he starts from, where he says that we kind of start from to begin with as a, just sort of a, we have to assume it, but it also can be an ultimate goal as well, right? Like, so with metaphysics, he's sort of always aiming everything that he does in the sciences toward whatever principles he establishes in the metaphysics. Is that sort of the way that you're reading him?
Well, close. Okay. Certain things that you said are spot on, and I love the way you put the first part of it. So I'm gonna repeat that and try to elucidate just how clever what you said is, because it is. Let's not make the first principle, the part I'm not agreeing with, and maybe it's because I'm misunderstanding it, is it seems to me what you just said about metaphysics is that sort of where we assemble the first principles and then they get distributed to the sciences. And that's not the case. Yeah, so. The way that Aristotle seems to understand the role of the first principle is that it comes to us through a series of experiences that we abstract from. And so we sort of grapple our way inductively toward a first principle. Grapple our way. We don't establish it that way. In fact, the way he seems to think of the establishing of it is we grapple our way toward it, and it's kind of a moment of illumination. And this isn't easy to know that I'm right about this. This is me generalizing from him talking about first principles, especially in, for instance, the posterior analytics. But remember that in the posterior analytics, most of what he's concerned with is the what happens next, which is the demonstration aspect of things. That once you have a first principle, then you make a series of logical moves in order to create a demonstrative science, a set of demonstrations. Sure. And that this is where the brilliance of your remark comes in, that you're starting with this sort of, not fuzzy exactly, but limited view of what that first principle is. Everything that you do demonstratively has to follow from that first principle in some manner. It doesn't mean that it is immediately evident to you that all that stuff is in there, but to God or to you at the end, it will be immediately evident. It's just not immediately evident in our limited capacities now, right? We have to work our way through the science to do that. But the ideal of a science is also a kind of closed loop, that what happens is you understand the first principle, you flesh it out, you figure out what follows from it, and all of the things that follow from the things that follow from it. And eventually you get to an end where you have fully fleshed out what's implied in that first principle. And so in other words, now you have the first principle on another level of understanding.
Hmm. And that's very different than our sort of common idea about science, right? Where it's almost more like the first part of that, where we're sort of searching for the principles, the sort of modern, experimental science approach to this stuff.
I think the quick and easy answer is yes, that this is an older notion of science where science can be finished. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, we don't think that anymore. I think we think in more or less the way Thomas Kuhn would have us believe that science goes through these paradigmatic shifts. And so our worldview changes. It's not necessarily that the Newtonian worldview is inherently inferior to the Einsteinian. It's that we have a different set of beliefs and truths that will eventually be set aside because there'll be something else that's post-Newtonian. There already is, and we'll go on from there. And yet, part of me thinks that we haven't totally let go of the Aristotelian point of view, because we do seem to look for completion constantly. Mm. Think about just the way that we deal with the fossil records, for instance, right? We're obviously getting new fossils all the time, even now, right? Things do keep getting fossilized. But there is this sort of underlying belief that we can demonstrate exactly where in the greater scheme of things dinosaurs fit and where, you know, different things occurred and why and so on. And so there is this belief that we can set aside, and we often do in modern science, but there is this belief that there is a kind of underlying pattern that can be found.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if we're able to find those principles, then Aristotle would be right, because then we could just use those principles the way that he talks about to create a kind of closed loop and a science of necessity. So, Yeah, it feels like it's just around. It always seems like it's just around the corner, I guess, in modern science. Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of think that the notion of the theory of everything, right? Mm. That people like Brian Greene are very interested in. That's a kind of new Aristotelianism. Now he might not agree with that. I've only met him a few times. He teaches, or at least he used to teach at Columbia, and I sat in on a few of his classes. Cool. Yeah, he's a great speaker, really interesting guy, and really great writer. Although I will admit that I spent a lot of time trying to work through the math and the footnotes to that book, the famous book, and there are big chunks of it that just have me writing all over it trying to figure it out. But at any rate, that's not what's important here. What's important here is that I do think that that's a kind of new Aristotelianism, where what he's trying to do is figure out a way that everything links up, because that's one of the problems in current science, right? Is that there seems to be a science of the big and a science of the small. This is Carlo Rovelli, is that his name? Mm-hmm. His way of talking about it is that there's a science of the big and there's a science of the small. And so when we look at the really small, the microscopic level, that seems to operate on the basis that kind of resists some of the laws that apply to bigger objects.
Yeah, sort of the science of the discrete versus the science of the continuous, I guess.
That's a great way of putting it. And that people like Green, and to some extent Rovelli, are looking for ways to show that there is a way in which those two things, that they're not incompatible. Because there's something intuitively wrong about them being incompatible, right? Because what is the big if not an agglomeration of the small? And what is the small if not a whittling down of the big? And so the idea that the rules are totally different to the small and the big, that's unsettling, I think, to many of us.
Totally.
And that's what I mean. I think we still have this kind of Aristotelian intuition that it should all make sense in the end. It should all add up. That to some extent science is accounting, and that we want to get it to the point where we're not in the red. We want everything to come out so that it all adds up in some way. All the expenditures are accounted for. All right. So the point that I'm trying to make here, that was an interesting digression, right? And it's not really a digression, because the point I'm trying to make here is that the distinction between praise and honor is this distinction that he keeps making over and over again about the relation, right? So that which is praiseworthy is lower in the hierarchy because it's in relation to something above it. So I'm praising, let's say that my son does something generous. I'm praising him for his generosity because generosity is not an end in itself. It leads to other things. His happiness, someone else's happiness, social well-being, social cohesion. It leads to all sorts of other things that are superordinate to it. Mm. Generosity is great. And you could even say that we would admire generosity even if it didn't lead to anything else. But the fact is that generosity does lead to other things. And I do kind of suspect that we admire generosity because of the things it leads to as much, if not more, than generosity in itself. Mm. Whereas happiness for him doesn't lead to anything else. Happiness is an end. And so it's not going to be praised because it's not in relation to anything else. Yep. Now, we might quibble with that idea, but I'm happy to hear the quibbles if you have them, Eric. But it seems to me that he just takes that as being the way it is, and it's a definitional thing. And I almost think that we either accept the definition or we don't. And if we accept the definition, then praise applies to things that are lower in the hierarchy, and honor applies to things that are at the top of at least their given hierarchy, mm-hmm. right? And so he gives us some examples, right? That we praise the good person for virtue, a good runner because of the character of running well, and then in each case it's in a certain state in relation to something good and excellent. So we praise the runner because he's a good runner, but also because running is a sign of health, a sign of success. There are all sorts of other reasons that are superordinate to the running as such, for which we might praise the runner. Doesn't mean that we might not appreciate just the fact that he's a great runner or she's a great runner, but that in our minds, in our ways of conceiving the world, running is not the top of the hierarchy, whereas happiness is, or can be, or at least for Aristotle is. He also gives us another way of understanding it, which is an argument from absurdity. This phrase, I gotta admit, did throw me for a while. So I've read like five different translations of it. I've read Aquinas' commentary on it, and now I feel like I'm a little stupid. Like maybe it wasn't as confusing as I made it out to be. But this is the line. This is also clear from Praises of the Gods. For these praises appear ridiculous because they are referred to us, but they are referred to us because, as we have said, praise depends on such a reference. Now that sentence did confuse the hell out of me at first, but I think it's clear what it means now. I'll read it again and sort of parse it. This is clear also from the praises of the gods. So this idea that praise is about something lower in the hierarchy is clear from when we try to praise the gods. For these praises appear ridiculous. The appear bothered me for a long time, but I think he's saying they appear ridiculous and they truly are ridiculous. They appear that way because they are ridiculous. Like I would have preferred in a sense that if it just said these praises are ridiculous, because then it makes it clear. Hmm. But I think that is what he means ultimately.
So if he's saying if we say the gods are such great runners and they're so smart and they're just, basically if we sort of ascribe human virtues to the gods, then we're relating them to humans. And that's what makes it seem ridiculous. Is that sort of
Yeah, but we could take it even a little farther, right? What do the gods do well? Well, they think well, right? So we might praise them for thinking well. Because just to remind people listening, Aristotle's views of the gods are not Greek mythology gods, and they're not Christian gods. And I don't know whether he believes in them or not. I'm not that concerned with his atheism, agnosticism, or deism, or whatever the hell it is. The way he uses the notion of the gods in this treatise is that they are totally self-sufficient, ends in themselves, that contemplate eternal truths, that do not have any kind of appetite or desire. They're all purely rational. And so we wouldn't even praise them for thinking well, because just by the nature of what they are, they by definition think well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I don't praise a stone for its hardness because by definition, a stone is hard. Now, I might honor the stone in some way. We can come back to that. But there's no point in praising the stone because it's not in relation to anything. That's just its essence. That's what it is.
Yes. So this sort of comes back to the that threefold that he, or not just sort of, it definitely comes back to that threefold he set up earlier, where we have stuff that's for the sake of something. It's purely instrumental stuff that's... And then on the other side of that, the one that he's sort of aiming at is the stuff that is just for its own sake, and then stuff that's kind of in between. And he seems to be going back and forth here between the in-between stuff that applies to us humans who do things instrumentally but also aim for something higher, and then for something that is already just automatically in that closed loop sort of way, achieved that thing. Yeah. Okay. I think I see.
Yeah, and in fact, that threefold division is kind of interesting, right? Because we can see it in a couple of ways. And here I'm going to be a little, I'm going to go back to my idea that Aristotle's more Pythagorean than he's sometimes thought of as being. Because on the one hand, you have the absolute gods, right? They can't be praised. They can only be honored because they are fully what they are, right? They're fully what they are. Meaning that they don't develop, they don't change. They're immutable, they're perfect. Whatever they do by definition and absolutely, right? So there's no point in praising them because there's nowhere, praise implies that you can keep going along that road and they don't have a choice. They can't get worse, they can't get better, they simply are what they are, which is why I don't envy the gods in Aristotle. It doesn't seem like a very interesting position to be in. On the lowest rung of things, we have animals, and more importantly, really, for us, within the realm of things that have some kind of purchase on rationality, we have children. And children are fully in potential to rationality and are slowly eking their way towards some kind of rationality. But they're in potentiality to it. They're not really rational yet, which is why we can't really praise them as being happy or virtuous, because they're in potential to that. They're developing toward that, right? Mm. We can praise it insofar as they're getting toward it. But developed humans, are in this weird interstitial space. And this is the Pythagorean element, where what they've done is they've developed their virtues to a certain extent, right? And they can continue to develop it. That's the Pythagorean idea, that they want to augment what is divine within them. Hmm. And so that's the problem with praising gods, is when we praise a god for thinking well, what we're really doing is we're saying, well, if the god were human, then that would certainly be praiseworthy, because that person can continue to go on and do better, and it's in relation to something else. But in gods, it's not in relation to anything else. It simply is what they are.
Hmm. I wonder if another. I don't know if I disagree with you on this point, on the Pythagorean point exactly, but I feel like there is a way to sort of take his argument here and bring it more in the direction of us humans here on Earth, where both sides of the praise and the honor can apply to humans. It's not just one is for humans and the other is for sort of a pure Pythagorean perfection of some kind. Actually, you mentioned potentiality. So he has that threefold with potentiality as well, where on the one side, we have the capability of reaching something. The child has potential for stuff in their life. Then at the very other side, there's actuality. But then he also does this in-between thing where you can reach a kind of first actuality, which is having an ability. So like using the house builder example that he uses, a child can someday grow up to build houses. The child can learn his craft. He can become a house builder. And that's a kind of actuality. But it's also a potentiality to build houses.
Right, right.
And then he can go on and start building houses. And then after a while, it seems like we start looking at this person and we don't just praise him for, oh, good, you've built you've become a house builder. I'm going to give you your certificate of house building and praise all the work you've done into becoming a house builder. Beyond that point, we might hold a special ceremony for the person after, you know, they're retiring or something, and say, look at all of these like beautiful houses. No one has built houses like this before. And, you know, there's something, he has reached a kind of complete and self-sufficient life as a house builder. I think that's the kind of way that he's getting us, or trying to get his audience to think about this difference between praise and honor. That's my sort of feeling about it. Yeah.
I agree with all of that. Why is that not Pythagorean to you, though? because look at what you just laid out. I think you laid it out very nicely. An actual child is probably not just pure potentiality, right? Almost from the beginning of a child's life, they're developing certain things that are brought into act and so on, even if it's just habits or personality quirks or whatever. But let's sort of idealize the three types, right? If we idealize it and take it as sort of in a kind of purity, then a child would be pure potentiality. It isn't anything yet. It's becoming something and is in potential to become something, good or bad, hopefully good. A God is pure actuality. It's never going to become more or less than what it is, right? And most of us are somewhere in between. And you're absolutely right that in one sense, the house builder is an actual house builder. They've learned all the skills. They've built some houses, right? But the next project hasn't begun yet. And so that house builder is at the same time in potential to house building because he or she's not doing it right at this moment and is about to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the other part, so to me, there is a Pythagorean element because you're getting more and more actualized as you go. I'm assuming that for a good house builder, the more houses that person builds, the better they're at it until they start to decline, which is always possible, but then they become less whatever. The goal is not to decline. The goal is to keep getting better and better and better. Almost, you know, we're musicians, so I always think about things from a musical point of view. Think about the way in which we sometimes talk about the three phases of a career, of a composer's career. We almost always break it into three, right? Early, middle, and late stages. And the early period is always one of moving from potentiality to actuality. So we look at their juvenilia, right? Jane Austen's first novels aren't as good as her greatest novels. Beethoven's first symphony, while it's great, is somewhat derivative of things that have been going on, whereas the third feels like he's come into his own in some fashion, right? That's often how people would describe it. Then you have the late period, and the late period can either be, as we sometimes talk about with Beethoven, kind of alienating. It can be where you've moved so far into your own idiosyncrasies as to kind of lose touch with what composition used to mean, and that's a kind of almost demonic idealization of the late period. Or you can think of the late period, and the same thing is said about people like Verdi and so on. Mm-hmm. Or you can think of the late period in the line of the career of someone like Rossini, where most of the things that he's doing in his late period, because he was basically retired, they were things that he was doing for, not exactly for fun, but he wasn't relying upon the money anymore. They were, some of them are somewhat trivial, some of them are religious, things like that, right? So you could see the third period is one of kind of decline or of less commitment or more of a personal expression, right? So you can see these sort of patterns of becoming what you are and kind of reaching this kind of height for that. Mm. And I think that's part, to me, that is Pythagorean.
Okay. Maybe that's all what I thought my disagreement was. So on the one hand, it's just between two different ways of interpreting this idea of the ideal, right?
Yeah.
I'm sort of seeing it, and maybe Pythagoras sees it this way too, and I just don't quite get it. But I see Aristotle anyway as treating an ideal more the way when you say to someone, oh, that's an ideal, that's a good ideal that you have. That's, to me, the sort of Aristotelian approach where there's this kind of goal that we're seeking to approximate, right? And the ideal is just a conceptualization of that goal. Whereas I think of the sort of Pythagorean approach, maybe I'm just conflating it with Plato, where the ideal is actually just reality and we're just too dumb to figure it out. But yeah. Or if we do figure it out, we just get it in this, and it's pure. We do capture that pure ideal. Whereas I don't know if Aristotle ever quite thinks we can fully capture the ideal.
But, I see. Yeah. I'm not convinced that Pythagoras necessarily does either, except as a sort of moment of transcendence, in the same way that you have in Buddhism, right? That when Buddha refuses to attain nirvana, that he's leaving a certain amount of imperfection in his existence in order to guide other people toward that perfection.
Yeah. There's more of a spiritual aspect.
Right.
To that.
Yeah. That once you attain the actual perfection, you've left. And maybe Aristotle doesn't really seem to have that notion, but then again, I don't know that he needs it really, because it doesn't make a practical difference that I see. Mm-hmm. I like the other thing that you said there that I would like to explore a little bit more about the notion of celebration. Like when, I suppose in the Aristotelian way of looking at it, when we have a graduation party, we're both praising and celebrating the person. Mm. On the one hand, we're praising them because this was, and you often hear people say this at graduation parties, ah, what a milestone. Mm. And now what are you going to do? What's next? So we're praising them in the sense that that this accomplishment is a stepping stone for other accomplishments. But at the same time, even if the person was like, I'm just going to drop out and work at an Exxon station for the rest of my life, you wouldn't then say, oh, well, screw it, then I'm canceling this graduation party. They still graduated, right? So you're still celebrating something that's done.
Yeah.
Now, this might be me over Aristotelianizing something, but there might be something to that, right? That is that a party like that is both celebration and praise, that the idea is that we're celebrating something that's done, an accomplishment. Just like I can imagine celebrating, let's go back to our house builder. The house builder finishes a particularly challenging commission and we celebrate that because it's done, right? Mm-hmm. And we could even celebrate the gaining of the commission because the gaining of the commission is done, right? So we celebrate things that are done, whereas we praise things that are in relation to something that's not yet done.
Yeah, so I guess in reality we mix. I totally buy that. In reality, we kind of mix these ways of praising people, but also honoring what they have accomplished.
Right, yeah. And he says something along these lines toward the end of that chapter where he says, he's talking about Eudoxus at this point, mm-hmm. and he's talking about how Eudoxus says that there's no point in praising pleasure because it's not really open to praise, but rather we should honor pleasure because of its superiority. And Aristotle says, you know, to a certain extent, he's arguing correctly. For praise is given to virtue, so he's shifting from pleasure to virtue, Aristotle is given to virtue since it makes us do fine actions, but celebrations are for achievements either of body or soul. So notice that praise is for the things that will lead to more fine actions, will lead to something else, whereas celebration is for an achievement. And I'm reading an achievement here in the strong sense, something that's done, something that's over. Hmm. And then he says an exact treatment of this, an exact discussion of this has to wait for a specialist in celebration. And I'm not that, and Aristotle's not that. So I guess we can leave it where he leaves mm-hmm. it. But now you had some, I want to hear your thinking on this, because you had said before to me separately, that part of this for you is bound up in the ancient notion of rhetoric. So you want to explain what
at the end when he's talking about celebration, he's talking about a specific, I think he uses encomia as his example. And he's basically mm-hmm. like, I don't really know much about this. And but he does categorize it in his rhetoric under one of the sort of three large genres of rhetoric that he discusses. And it's kind of interesting to sort of, I don't know, because of this sort of threefold structure and the way that he's talking about this stuff, it got me thinking, oh yeah, he is sort of talking about how this fits into our rhetoric about happiness and how we deal with that. And then something that's sort of odd is that in the rhetoric, he basically associates all this political stuff, including the theme of happiness, not with encomia or with it's called epideictic rhetoric, and we can talk about that mm-hmm. too. But he associate more with what the governing body does, with the kind of a deliberative rhetoric about what we ought to do, and then that's about sort of creating a situation that allows the most number of people to live happy lives. I guess that seems to be his argument in the rhetoric, mm-hmm. whereas here he's saying happiness ultimately is a matter for epideictic rhetoric, which is more the kind of celebratory rhetoric that we've brought up. So I found that kind of fascinating. There are a few other sort of complicated ways I could try to talk about this stuff, and then you can interrupt me if you want. But basically, when he's talking about this highest form of so it's not just beyond the sort of praise beyond praise, this honor as a praise beyond praise. And he's connecting it with that third part of his hierarchy, the final highest part. I was reminded of the criteria that he gives for the highest good, right? That it needs to be complete, right? Or they're ultimate in some way and self-sufficient. And it basically these two, or the, I mean, he, there's possibly more criteria, right? That it's something that we want, but completion and self-sufficiency seem to be the two main ones that he has in mind, and they complement each other. Like they don't just it's not just a list of this is here are the criteria, check, check, right? They actually have a relationship with each other. They right. kind of complement each other. So with completeness, for example, we're talking about something that's, just to be clear, it's something that's not for the sake of something else, right?
Right.
So it's defined negatively, of course, in relation to our activities and specifically the future. So if something is complete or ultimate or whatever, there's no goal beyond that one. There's no future goal. It's sort of negatively defined against the future. That destination has basically been reached. So that's completeness. And then self-sufficiency kind of complements it because it, basically that means that it does not require any more from, you know, there are no more conditions that need to be met once we've reached it. So it doesn't depend on anything outside of itself. There are nothing needs to be added to it. And that kind of, the way I read that is that it's sort of addressing, again, negatively, the past or sort of the causal conditions for a thing. So on the one hand, we have completeness, which relates to the future, and self-sufficiency, which relates to the past. And I think now you can sort of see where I'm going with the connection with rhetoric, but I don't know how to clarify it super well. But basically, there's a similar relationship between two of those three forms of rhetoric that Aristotle discusses. And they kind of come as a pair, I think, right? So he has these three forms of rhetoric. I guess I should probably try to clear, or maybe you can help me clarify just what they are, right? There's, he calls them, or some people call them the forensic, right? Which is trying to decide what has happened. Deliberative, trying to decide what to do, and then epideictic, and that's the one that he spends the least amount of time on in the rhetoric, and it's the and it is interesting that we just translate it as the way it's written in originally, so a lot of us don't even really know what to do with that third one, but it's associated with the present, unlike the other two.
But that one, that did throw me, yeah. Actually. So I was thinking that one was going to be the one that you associated with the past. Or is it Aristotle that has the temporality?
That's actually Aristotle's. That's his own thing.
So he says that the praise one, the epideictic, that's about the present. So we're praising someone in the present. Is that what you're saying?
Well, this is where it's weird because it sounds like when he says there are these three forms of rhetoric, it's going to be like his other three folds, right? There's going to be some sort of like hierarchy maybe or something along those lines. But that's actually, two of them seem to have a special relationship. So we could actually divide rhetoric not into three, but into two. And in fact, Aristotle does this himself when he first introduces the categories. He basically says that it's the listeners who ultimately decide the purpose of the speech. And there are two basic kinds of listener. There are judges, and then there are spectators. Mm. So the judge is someone who basically faces a decision, right? About they're deciding about actions to take. That's the future orientation of deliberative rhetoric, and that's the one that he seems to prize the most and spend the most time on, or think that is the most important in his discussion of rhetoric. Then there's the other kind of judge who's basically just there to establish facts. And so for him, right. That's usually if you're in a courtroom trying to establish, you know, what has happened. So in any case, if we're talking about either kind of listener, either kind of judge, the role of the rhetorician is basically to help them resolve a controversy of some kind, right? Basically, the listener is judging something outside of the speech. We're judging something, sort of what to do in the future, or we're judging what has happened before, but it's always outside of the speech. That's the sort of, the content is the most important thing. And there's a kind of practical or instrumental purpose for that situation, right? But then the other kind of listener, that second kind, it's the observer or the spectator. It's like theoros, basically it's related to the word theory, right? And they're just basically your job in that situation is not to decide whether to praise something or not, even though the speech might be praising something, even though the speech might be saying, "Oh, congratulations, you made it to the 12th grade and you finished and all that good stuff." But really, your job as a listener is just to be a spectator. You're judging the speech and the speaker. You're not judging the content of the speech, except insofar as it relates to the more important thing, which is the speech itself, the performance, right? The sort of artistry of the speech. Basically, that's my sort of take on that distinction there. And epideictic rhetoric would then be the one where we're not playing the role, the listener is not playing the role of a judge. We're just sort of spectating the speech, enjoying it. Sometimes people dismiss it as kind of pure entertainment, right? Or maybe it's like just a whatever. It was associated with the some of the enemies of the of like Plato and Aristotle. Basically, they just go out and give these pretty speeches. That's sort of the their way of talking about it. But there is something about epideictic rhetoric that I find kind of fascinating, since we're not trying to figure out what to do or judge what has already happened. And that suggests to me that it kind of meets up with, in a weird way, his criteria for the highest good.
And therefore for honor.
And therefore for honor. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So that's a really long-winded way of connecting this sort of highest form of talking about happiness with epideictic rhetoric.
And you said the temporality thing is his. So he's the one that says that epideictic rhetoric is bound up in the present. And
yeah.
That's because we're absorbed in the speech.
Yes.
We're in the moment of the speech.
Yes.
Interesting.
Or at least that's my understanding of it. Maybe we'll find out. you'll read through and it says, actually, he says this. But when I read just the beginning of the rhetoric, that's the way he kind of laid it out.
Yeah, I'll have to review that part. That's not something that stuck with me, the temporality. I mean, there's often an implicit temporality in a lot of what he does, which is why Heidegger is so taken with Aristotle. But that's really interesting. I guess I would have guessed it to be a little different. I mean, obviously, deliberative is future-oriented. But I would have thought that epideictic was past-oriented, because you're talking about deeds, things that are done.
Yeah,
And even though I can see how the forensic might be construed as past-oriented, I can also see it being construed as present-oriented, in that what happened to make this what this is. You know what I mean? Like explaining what we're doing now.
Well, think of like a wedding toast that kind of, and this is, there are also kind of negative versions of this, but let's think of the wedding toast where you raise your glass, you go clink, 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 and then you say, if you're really good, and people will even say, oh, that guy's really good at giving wedding toasts. And then you give a great wedding toast, and it starts off with some like a little quip or whatever that gets everyone like laughing. And then you say, you start off in talking about how you first met one of the people in the couple, or how you knew them since whenever. And then you have some story about them, about the past, and you kind of bring that into play. And then you eventually that kind of leads up to a kind of climax where you start talking about the future and about, what you see happening in the future, and how you what's going to happen with their relationship, and how they're so much better together than you are with your wife, or whatever. Sort of, you can have a little joke at the end, and then everyone claps and they raise and they drink. But what's happening there is not just that you are sort of talking about what they were like in the past, or about what they ought to do and sort of encouraging them to do in the future or whatever. You're kind of using those things to kind of stretch out, to create a moment, basically, to take something about their lives as a couple and create a moment out of it that kind of stretches it out and just holds it in the present. That's my sort of my take on that form of rhetoric, I guess. Yeah.
Right. And if we're saying that there's something really interesting here that I'm not quite able to excavate the way I want to, but if I'm following you correctly, there's something interesting I'm sure there is, even if I'm not following you correctly. But so in the speech example you just gave, the wedding speech example, there's a forensic and deliberative moment. Mm. But the emphasis is on a kind of inflation of the present, that we're supposed to be in the moment, that the past and the future are absorbed in the moment. But what we're actually commemorating is this moment, which is the culmination of the past and is the budding fruit that can lead to the future, but that for this moment, we're dwelling in this moment and we're celebrating this moment. We raise our glasses to this moment.
Yeah.
And happiness, that makes this moment have a kind of stability that we all recognize is not really true of our typical experience of the present, right?
Yeah.
That our typical experience of the present is always fleeting. Mm-hmm. For instance, like I'm really thinking right now, like I'm sure it sounds like I'm an idiot when I'm just talking because I'm really thinking about what you've said to me, right? So in a way, while I'm also thinking about what's been said and what I'm planning to say, I'm really sort of caught up in the idea. And so the moment of the present is dilating. Mm. And there's a kind of stability to that, right? That I'm really living. When we say let's live in the moment, in one sense, that's stupid, of course. But in another sense, it's not, right? That there's this way in which the moment, the present, can open up for you. Mm. Most of the time it doesn't, right? Most of the time I'm thinking, oh, I want a snack. That's future oriented. Or, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. That's past oriented. And we're not spending a lot of time just with ourselves. That's why in meditation we focus on breathing, the thing that's happening right this moment that we can't help but have happen in this moment. And breathing, while you can see a future and past orientation within it, the main focus of breath is that I'm here now, continuing to survive. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way in which happiness is like that, right? That happiness, it's not that happiness doesn't involve the past. I can probably only be happy if I can look back at the past as having some kind of accomplishment. If I feel like I've done nothing but fail, I'm probably not happy. And I want to look to the future as though it has some kind of hope. If I think that in the next second, I'm probably going to be destroyed in some fashion, whether death or ruination, then I'm probably not too happy, right? So it has its past and future orientations built within it. But that the actual experience of happiness is a dwelling in the present. I'm happy now. I've constructed this happiness so that it doesn't feel fleeting. That happiness can, if I think of happiness as an emotion, the way that we often think of happiness, then happiness is fleeting. I'm happy now, I'm content now, but almost anything could come through that door at the moment and ruin it. Mm. Whereas Aristotle's view of happiness is much more stabilizing and stabilized, that once you've really attained happiness, then great misfortunes can displace that happiness, but you can suffer small misfortunes pretty easily. And even great misfortunes don't have to do anything but temporarily derail your happiness, that you can get it back. And that one of the things he said that we discussed in the last episode is that if you're truly happy, then you can't be made unhappy by even the greatest misfortunes. You can no longer, it can be possible that you're no longer in the state of happiness, but you won't be miserable. Mm. If you've really cultivated happiness in a certain way. So there is a temporal element there, that what you're trying to do is take something that we normally think of as fleeting, the present, and you're trying to make it endure.
Yeah.
In the same way that we do with meditation and with these speeches, the wedding speech and so on. Now, that's really fascinating. I've probably bungled it in my translation of it, but it's really fascinating.
Well, I mean, I'm bungling it in my thought of it as well. But I mean, I think I like the connection there between the way we talk about happiness in possibly an epideictic rhetoric, and the way happiness actually seems to work, which is, I think, what you're talking about for Aristotle.
Yeah.
It's kind of stretched out in a prolonged present, and almost like, If we associate epideictic rhetoric with more like art, something closer to entertainment or art, then that's an interesting kind of comparison, because then the happy person is someone who's created a kind of work of art out of their life.
Right. Yeah. And art, of course, has its own really interesting temporal nature, right? Because art is different from artifact, but it's similar in some ways. Like when we say that an artwork, when we go to see an artwork, there's a sense in which it has a kind of completeness to it, a pastness to it, like Kant likes to say. Any more brushstrokes would be too many, any fewer would be too few. It has just the right amount of brushstrokes. It's done. Mm-hmm. It's done in a strong sense, right? And so it has that kind of pastness. At the same time, it has a kind of futurity to it, that when we look at art, there's always an as-if aspect to it. It's not just saying here is what it is, but it's also saying here's what might be. Mm-hmm. That art always has a kind of utopian moment, even when it's art of, even if it's Francis Bacon and it's art of total destruction and so on. There's this way in which the as if is enough, even if the as if seems like it's pointing to the demonic or the diabolical.
Yeah, there's a fantasy element to it, and we can kind of enter that fantasy and sort of live in that for however long we're engaging with the art.
Right. And then both of those elements, that pastness and that futurity, do get absorbed in the thing that we think. I mean, what do when we go to see an artwork? We contemplate it, right? We stand in front of it and we think about it. The idea of an artwork, like we would think that someone who goes too fast through an art museum is probably not a good viewer of art. They're taking a look, and they could say, well, what? I saw it. I saw all the lines. I looked at all the lines. What else is there to do? You know, you can imagine like what we might think of as a Philistine saying, look, I saw everything. And then I went on to the next one. I saw it. And then the next one saw it. And we probably would think of that person as a bad viewer of art. The person who just stares at it and doesn't consider any of the sort of inherent realm of possibility and the as-if quality of it, that's probably also a bad viewer of art, even if they spend a lot of time in front of it. So once again, we're in this kind of Goldilocks zone of trying to find the right mixture of pastness and futurity in order to make this moment of the present. And notice that's another thing, a way in which we talk about art a lot, that the so-called aesthetics of presence, that there's a difference between going to see the Mona Lisa at the Louvre and just seeing the magnet that my mother has of the Mona Lisa on her fridge, mm-hmm. right? That even though all the lines and colors are the same, let's imagine that this magnet is the same exact size. It's not, but let's imagine it is the same exact size as the Mona Lisa, and it's so beautifully rendered that it captures all the details. Yet there's still this sense in which that's not the artwork.
Yeah.
That there's something about the presence, mm-hmm. and so presence here is almost a pun, right?
And there's work that you have to do to get that presence when you're going. If you're going to see the Mona Lisa, for example, you have to kind of bracket the huge crowd that's inevitably there, and the way that it's presented
right.
behind the glass, and all the security guards, and all the noise. There's so much stuff that some people might just feel like they didn't really see the Mona Lisa, even though they were, even if they felt like they were prepared to do it.
Right. Yeah. And then how does that maybe apply to happiness, right? Because we've talked over and over again about the exterior versus the interior view, that it seems to me that a lot of what Aristotle is doing is from the exterior point of view. How do we decide that person X is or was happy, rather than person X thinking to himself, am I or am I not happy? And so there's maybe a certain amount of work that we have to do as observers of happiness in order to properly acknowledge, celebrate, and experience that external point of happiness, right? That if we're not geared to see it, if we're not Aristotelian enough and we think, oh, well, whoever's wealthiest is happy, then we're not seeing happiness very clearly. We're not doing the work that we need to do in order to appreciate true happiness. There's something really, yeah, no, it's really interesting. And this is, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back too hard, but this is exactly why I enjoy what we're doing. I wouldn't have had these thoughts on my own.
Oh, same here.
All coming, yeah. Thank you. All right, so should we move on to
sure.
chapter 13? All right, yeah. then. Chapter 13 presents, really, it's, Irwin subtitles it an introduction to the virtues. So really, it's an introduction to the books that are coming, books 2 through 6, at least. But certainly book 2, where he's first going into the virtues. And therefore, a lot of what's being said here is preparation for things that will be said more clearly later. And so we don't need to spend a ton of time, I don't think, on chapter 13. We'll see where the conversation goes. But in a way, he's just setting up, what do we do next? Well, if we've established that happiness is a certain type, as he puts it, a certain sort of activity of the soul in accord with complete virtue. So is it the exercise of virtue? Is it the realization of virtue? All of that's left vague. Is it one virtue? Is it all the virtues? All that's left somewhat vague, right? So Kraut and Ackerl can kind of take a breather for a moment. We know that it's involved in virtue. And so if it's involved in virtue, then we probably need to know more about virtue. That seems to follow pretty well, right? That if it involves virtue in some fashion, then we're going to know more if we know more about virtue. And he says, you know, the true politician wants to put more effort into virtue than anything else, because the true politician wants to make citizens good and law abiding, right? So even if there are other goals in a society, the one that's going to make the society function best is virtue. And so therefore, notice what has he done now? He's done so far. He's done a couple things. He said that we've already established that happiness is in relation to virtue, therefore we ought to know about virtues. We've already established that happiness is the concern of political science, and political science wants politics and society to function well, and that happens because of the virtues, therefore we should understand virtues. And then he gives us an example about the Spartans and the Cretans.
Oh, the Spartans and the Cretans.
Yeah. yeah.
Kind of wonder, and just at the very beginning here, it's a silly thought, but he says the true politician, and then he says, you know, and like the Spartans and the Cretans, he's sort of, I guess nowadays we'd say he's subtweeting the Athenians here, right? Like that he's kind of saying, I don't know if you guys are true politicians, but, you know, maybe you will be someday.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I guess I don't know enough about his view of Sparta. I always think of Plato as being the one that
yeah,
extols
yeah,
Sparta beyond all compare. But that's what you're reading into this. I didn't think about that.
He might even be using it as a kind of generic, like using Sparta as the kind, because of course the Athenians see themselves as kind of rivals with Sparta. So if you say like, oh well, you know what the Russians do in a modern, if we're talking about modern America, that's kind of if you use them as a way to, I don't know, to bring down your own people a peg, to get them to maybe think about their role a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that at all. That's interesting. I mean, he spends a lot of time talking about the true politician because he wants to distinguish people who are in politics, like probably most people in politics, that are looking out for their own good and for mm-hmm. the good only of the people that they, you know, the lobbyists or whatever people are yeah. in their ear. Versus the true politician that's trying to find the proper hierarchy, that's trying to find the proper arrangement so that everything functions as well as possible. But yeah, I guess he is in a way saying that the examples are Sparta and Crete. And I don't know anything about his views on Crete, and very little about his views on Sparta, other than that, you know, Sparta's often the example of a kind of rigorous society for ancient Greece that they mm-hmm. that you know. So maybe that's part of it. That's interesting. Then the next bit, he goes on to say, you know, well, we're not talking about just any virtue, because virtue just means excellence. Arete just simply means excellence. So plants have virtues, rocks have virtues. But we're only talking about human virtue and human happiness, because that's what we're concerned with, right? And that this would have to be a virtue of the soul, not the body. And it has to be a certain activity of the soul. And it can't be just any part of the soul. It's not the nutritive part of the soul. Because that's not, so we're back to the function argument, in other words. So notice there's some recapitulation here. He's saying that happiness has to do with virtue, that therefore it applies to political science, which that's from very early in the book. Mm-hmm. And now he's coming to the function argument from chapter 7 of the book.
That's a good point. I actually didn't think of chapter 13 as basically an actual, a proper conclusion to the chapter. But that helps me to see it that way. Yeah.
The first part of it, I think, is, yeah. I mean, it's a real bridge in that way, summarizing the things that we have to remember, that happiness is involved in virtue, that virtue has to do with the way that society works best and therefore has to be very well calibrated, that you have to figure out what virtues are most important, how they're arranged, right? What the calibration is. And that it has to be things that apply to the human soul versus the body, because it's because of the function argument, that what we're concerned with is what is specific to our essence, our purpose. And that doesn't mean that we don't have to understand all the virtues, though, even if it, and this part is a part that Kraut makes a big deal out of, right? That when he says, the bit about the doctor that's healing your eyes also has to know about the whole body to some extent, because after all, if you have eye problems that are related to, say, the blood, your blood, you got to deal with the blood issue, or else you can fix the eyes and they'll just go bad again, right? And so it's the same thing with the virtues. Even if one is the most important, that doesn't mean you can only focus on that one. You've got to get the right calibration. And so we have to understand all the virtues. And he gets rid of anything that's nutritive, because that's not part of the human function, right? So we're back to the three parts of the soul. You have the nutritive, the sensitive, and the rational. And he's getting rid of the nutritive altogether, in part because it has human reason has no purchase on that, right? I can say to myself all I want, stop growing, and it's not going to happen, right? I could do things to myself. I could poison myself in various ways, but that's inhibiting the nutritive soul. It's not making the nutritive soul listen to reason, right? Just like I can inhibit a tree from sapling from going into a full blown tree, that doesn't mean that the sapling has listened to reason, right?
Yeah.
It means I've used reason to get in the way of what the nutritive soul would be doing. So he gets rid of the nutritive soul. And he says, what remains are the other two parts of the soul. And one, they both are involved in reason to some extent. One can listen to reason, as one would to a father or a friend, or one can have reason. And so the other two parts of the soul here, obviously, are the sensitive soul, which is, or the appetitive soul, if you prefer, or the desiring soul, that is open to listening to reason. And then the other part of the soul, the rational soul, has reason in itself. And the examples he gives are the continent versus the incontinent when thinking about desiring soul, and then mathematics when you think about the rational soul, right? That mathematics is a way of understanding not even the world, really, but rather a kind of abstract way of logic, really, of the way that thought works. That mathematics is a demonstrative science, and therefore it's showing you how thought works adequately and how order works. And you don't, while you can, of course, apply it to the real world when you're studying math, you don't have to. When you're studying pure math, you're just studying that 2 + 2 = 4, not that 2 apples and 2 more apples = 4 apples, or 2 oranges and 2 apples = 4 pieces of fruit. You're not worried about that aspect of it, right? Now, the other part's the more interesting one, the incontinent versus the continent.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to always be the case, that middle, whenever there are three with Aristotle, that middle one that kind of is like, oh yeah, that's really where the action seems to be.
Yeah. And so he's saying that this part of the soul is non-rational, but it shares in reason. It can listen. And then he says, in the continent and the incontinent person, we praise their reason. Notice we don't honor it. We praise it because it's in relation to something else. It can lead to something else, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're talking, and notice we praise their reason for both the continent and the incontinent, because the problem with the incontinent person, according to Aristotle, is not that their thinking is bad. In fact, if their thinking was bad, they wouldn't be incontinent. They would just be barbaric or animalistic, mm-hmm. right? So if so let's go through this. The continent person is the person that realizes that drinking too much alcohol is bad for you, and therefore that incontinent person doesn't do it. The animalistic person doesn't even think about whether it's bad or not. I just like being drunk. I want to be drunk all the time, so I just do it. It feels good to be drunk. I'm not worried about whether or not that makes me a good citizen or it gives me purchase on longevity or any of that. I'm just doing what I enjoy in my base animalistic nature. The incontinent person is in between. The incontinent person knows it's wrong, knows it's a bad idea, and yet does it anyway. And for Aristotle, this is a real puzzle. And it should be a puzzle. It's a puzzle for any of us that have any kind of addiction issues. Because a lot of times when we have an addiction issue, we realize that what we're doing is bad for us, that it's deleterious to our health, it's deleterious to our social relationships, it's deleterious to our love life, to our friendships, to anything that you can think of, right? And yet, there's something in the addict that even with all their good thinking, and a lot of times some of the addicts I know and have known have much more fleshed out thoughts on the repercussions than the continent person, because the continent person is in the privileged position of not having to think about it that much anymore, right? You get into a kind of habit, as Aristotle will show us later in the book, of continence.
Like, and am I right in remembering that you could be an incontinent person who also basically is the opposite of an addict, right? Who basically sort of seems like a good person?
Addicts seem like bad people to you?
I just mean from the Aristotelian standpoint, from like the virtues versus the continence versus incontinence.
Well, what's the distinction then? So how does the example I'm using is just an example. We can think of incontinence in ways that don't have to be construed as addiction. Although right now I'm having a hard time, since anything can be an addiction. I'm having a hard time coming up with one that's not. So maybe if you have a devil's advocate point of view, you can flesh that out. But let me just restate what I'm trying to say, which is that the addict's thinking isn't bad. The addict knows that there's a problem, but there's something in their way of desiring that their rationality doesn't have full control over. So the difference between the continent person and the incontinent person isn't the thinking, it isn't the reason, it's the application of the reason. And this is an important distinction for Aristotle, because he's gonna divide the virtues into character virtues and intellectual virtues. And there's a relationship, they're not separated. The character virtues are to some extent beholden to the intellectual virtues, or at least regulated by. So the easiest one to see is phronesis, right? The practical wisdom. That what practical wisdom does is it calibrates temperance, bravery, all the virtues of character. Now, you get intellectual virtues and character virtues differently. One has to do with schooling, in a sense, or being taught. And that would be intellectual virtues. And the other has to do with habituation. Now, they both participate in habituation and in being taught in various ways. But in their baseline structure, one is about habituation, and those are the virtues of character. So to really have the virtues of character, and we don't have to clarify all this yet, because that's going to be the basic topic of the next book. But basically, the way that I understand it, at least, is that virtues of character have to be inculcated. That if you get to be my ripe old age and you haven't learned anything about bravery or temperance, it's probably pretty late for you. Maybe not too late, but pretty late for you, because they have to be habitual. They're not things that you think your way toward. And that's the lesson of the incontinent person, what is sometimes referred to as akrasia. And Aristotle has a big chunk of a later book on this, so we're not going to have to get all the nitty-gritty here. But the basic distinction here is that the incontinent person has developed virtues of intellect, but has not properly developed virtues of character. And so when the intellect, when the practical wisdom, phronesis, is saying to the incontinent person, don't drink. You know better than this. The incontinent person is like, yeah, no, I know. And yet there's still something about them. Their temperance is lacking in such a way that they just don't have good habits. And I think that Aristotle's on to something here, because I think that this really tells us a lot about what we should be thinking about in our justice system and everything else. We do think about this, right? That's why we have extenuating circumstances. That's why we have the difference between murder and manslaughter and things in the first degree and second degree and so on, is because we recognize that it's not all about reason. We recognize it in various ways. We don't come down as hard on people usually when they're in states of great distress. as we do when we think of them as doing it in a calculated way. That's why we talk about premeditated murder. We do think there's a difference between I'm in a moment, I get really mad, and I lash out and kill someone, right? Right, there are all these levels. There's the premeditated. I've decided in cold blood this person's going to die. We tend to think of that as the worst of the worst because they're using their reason to do something abhorrent. Then we think of someone who's lost their reason temporarily. They're normally a rational person. They would never kill anyone. In this moment, they're overheated because of a threat to their child or whatever. We justify it in all sorts of different ways. And they kill, right? And then there's the person that simply never was rational, didn't develop that aspect, that has bad habits, in other words, right? And we might make excuses for that person. We say, well, you know, this person was raised in an environment of criminality. They just don't know any better. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have on the one hand the person that knows better, but premeditates it, the murder, and does the murder, even though they know it's wrong and tries to find ways to get away with it. And that is sort of the ultimate evil for most of us. Then there's the person who knows right from wrong, but in that moment is incapacitated. Their reason is incapacitated either through drugs, sickness, alcohol, or just being totally enraged so that their reason is unseated. And then there's the person that just never developed the right viewpoint at all, right? Mm-hmm. That they lived in such a condition that can you really expect somebody who has never been treated with any respect to really know anything about respect? You know, that they saw their parents get abused and they were abused. And, you know, like, can you really expect that person to make the same kind of decisions that somebody who didn't have those disadvantages would make? Is it fair to do that? Even though you could point the cases where somebody does, right, where somebody has been abused and systematically degraded and still does the right thing. And we can think of them as almost a paragon of virtue. Hmm. But can you really expect it? Is it reasonable to expect it? And it seems to me that that's what Aristotle's up to here, right? Is that he's making these distinctions, that the incontinent person is somebody who knows the right thing, but just can't apply it because they haven't developed the virtues of character in such a way that they are habitual. And that's ultimately what they have to be, right? And we know this. I think this is certainly true, right? That I can talk myself up to be brave in a certain situation. I can prepare myself. But if someone jumps at me in a dark alley and I run away, and I don't protect my friend that I'm walking with, and I, to some extent, you might say, well, I don't have the habit of being brave in situations like that. You know, I mean, it becomes a crapshoot at that point. Can I really expect that I'm going to know what to do? Because after all, in a way, we're talking about what we call the fight or flight response. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, if I haven't habituated myself into fighting, then I probably won't.
True. Yeah.
And I'm not sure that Aristotle's looking well, in a way, he's condemning, I guess. I mean, clearly he's privileging continence over incontinence, as we all should and would. But at the same time, he's not seeing the incontinent person as being irrational. He's seeing the incontinent person as having a kind of conflict of the soul. That if we have these two elements of the soul that are in play, the deliberative part of the soul, the desiring part of the soul, well, let's not bring deliberation into this because that's actually a little more complicated. Because that's deliberation in Aristotle goes one of two ways. You can have boulesis, which is purely rational, and then you can have the other thing, which I forget what he calls it even, where it's not purely rational. It's the interaction between the phronesis and the character. But here, what I'm more concerned with is just the nature of what is it that we say about the incontinent person. And for him, he seems to think there's a conflict of souls, right? That the incontinent person has the best of intentions as far as the thinking part of the soul is concerned, the rational part of the soul, but hasn't developed habitually, whether through their own fault or through the fault of their upbringing, hasn't developed the habits that have to be in place in order to remain continent.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you came up with the example of you sort of being in an alley or whatever, and then, you know, doing the fight or flight leading to flight, especially if, you know, even if the rational part of you thinks, oh, no, I ought to stand my ground here or whatever. I can imagine someone who's not been habituated to basically to the fight stuff, right, to that side of things, who is nevertheless also incontinent in the way that they are maybe addicted to thrills or something, or they whenever something kind of like surprises them, they want more of that, right? And so maybe they enter that situation and they're like, oh yeah, and they just jump in, and they just, even if that happens to agree with, if they were to stop and think about it, they would think, oh yeah, I ought to stand my ground. And then they do stand their ground, but for the wrong reason. I guess that's what I was trying to get at. Is it possible for someone to have that kind of incontinence while still somehow doing or a lot of people will say, oh, that's just the OCD part of me, that X, Y, or Z, right? It's the part of you you can't really control that still, you know, makes sure that the oven is turned off when you leave, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, it's not like you didn't reason through it and think, well, did I turn off the oven? Did I not turn off the oven? Do I even remember or not remember? That almost doesn't matter, right? It's just that feeling you get of needing to check the oven. That happens to meet up with, oh, that's probably a good habit to have, to make sure the oven's turned off.
Right, but it's not a good habit to have if you go in, you check the oven. Like, you can imagine how it could be bad. Here's my little fantasy of how that would be, right? Yeah. So I turn off the oven, I get in my car, I drive 20 minutes to work. I get to my parking spot, and I'm like, oh, shit, did I turn off the oven or not? And I drive all the way back. So now that's 40 minutes gone. Yeah. I go in, of course the oven's off. I always turn the oven off. I get in my car, I go back, and then totally irrationally, I know I turned it off, but for some reason it doesn't feel right. I got to see it again, or maybe I didn't do the thermostat right, and then it becomes unhealthy. And you can imagine that happening once or twice and being like, well, no, it was a good thing I checked. Now I'm secure. But if you can't ever get to that point of security, then it's not a good thing, right? And so you're not calibrated properly in a way, and you could blame that on OCD or whatever else. But no, your example is a great one. Like the one that comes to my mind are the tornado chasers, right? Like they're chasing the tornadoes for a thrill, and sometimes they die. There's no really good reason to do that, except that it's clearly not the rational part of their soul that's making them do this. It's the desiring part of their soul. Sure. They like that thrill.
And then every now and then it comes across as a kind of virtue, where it's like, wow, they're being really brave up against that tornado. And so and so then maybe for Aristotle, that insofar as we might call it virtuous, it's totally accidental. It's not really a genuine virtue.
You can definitely do the right thing for the wrong reasons, right? And in this case with the tornado chasers, I'm not sure I would even call it the right thing for the wrong reasons. But let's switch it back to...
Well, let's say there's someone who's like running away from a tornado, and they stop and pick them up in the car or whatever. That could be sort of part of the thrill of the tornado chasing.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I think you're right. You can do the right thing for the wrong reasons or whatever, or seem brave when what you're really doing is being careless and rash, right? And we're going to see this, of course, in the Doctrine of the Mean. And it's already, I think we're already getting to a point where our conversation for the Doctrine of the Mean has a little more meat to it than just, oh, neither too much or too little, right? Mm. Because you could, if bravery were a quantifiable thing, which of course it's not, but let's say that you could somehow mathematically register the amount of bravery, like the coefficient of bravery versus the threat, right? And you say, well, standing up to two muggings is the equal to standing up to one tornado, right? I know this is ridiculous, but bear with me for a moment. But the difference is the two muggings were things that were you didn't have a choice about. It's not like you sought out the mugger, unless you did, in which case you're an idiot. But you probably didn't seek out the mugger. So standing up to the mugger is forced upon you by your situation. Going over to the tornado and seeking out the tornado is not, right? Mm-hmm. Not evacuating when you know you should. That is not avoiding a bad situation. That's running headlong into it. And so... For Aristotle, the circumstances are going to matter, right? It's not just that you could say that mathematically, in some fashion, those two instances of bravery are the same, and yet because one's totally pointless, it's not the same, or at least the way I'm construing it is totally pointless. For some random person listening that is a tornado chaser and you think you have all these great reasons for it, maybe you do. I don't know. You know, write us and come sit in on our on the next episode and we'll discuss it. But it seems to me that even if you don't like that specific example, there's got to be a place for that where you can exhibit bravery in the wrong way, and that becomes rashness for him. And so it's not just a matter of finding too much or too little, but calibrating it in the larger sense of where does this fit within my overall notion of life and liveliness and happiness and so on. So where he's heading, of course, now is going to he's laid out we already have the recapitulation, and now he's laying out that we have the two parts of the soul that we're considering. There's the rational part of the soul, and then there's the part that's open to reason that can be guided by reason, and that they have their own sets of virtues. That the rational soul has the intellectual virtues, and the desiring part of the soul. And sensitive part of the soul has its own set of virtues, and those are the virtues of character versus the virtues of thought. And now he's going to just go in that order. He's going to look at the virtues of the character and talk about how we can inculcate those and develop those, and then he's going to go through the virtues of thought and eventually get to the relationship among them, which is where we get to book 6, and that's a very challenging book, but we're far away from that, because where we will be heading when we return is book 2. And it's that one's a relatively short book, but there's a lot of meat in it. So I don't know. Is there anything else about chapter 13 we should say before we call it?
No, I think that was a good overview.
All right. So we will see you for book 2 in our next episode.
Can't wait.